Well, thank you for this kind invitation. I really enjoyed it 3 years ago, and even more so now. So I was kind of debating with myself what to talk about. I have several talks, one of them about defibrillation, another one about hibernating species, and yet another one about pacemaker and conduction system of the heart. But I think this one fits very nicely to today's program, and both morning talks are really set the stage for what I'm going to talk about in this talk. And I would like to start by a couple remarks. Recently I read several interesting papers about this apparent paradigm shift which we experience in biology and biophysics, what happened in physics in the beginning of 20th century, and actually what Alan showed very nicely in this interesting story with Laplace. The paradigm shift from essentially molecular or particular approach to distributed systems, and in a sense we are going back to the future, essentially, in the systemic approach. This picture actually is taken from a classical work of Thomas Lewis, published in 1925, third edition. First edition it probably was in 1916, so it's really nice. But essentially what I'm trying to say is that probably about 50 or so years and maybe 3-4 generations of brightest minds in biology studied this particular approach, trying to find a silver bullet to treat cardiac arrhythmias, and so we still didn't find one. And going from cell to tissue to whole organ, and essentially we are still left with only one viable option for treatment of cardiac arrhythmias, despite all these beautiful three-dimensional structures, which was invented exactly at the time when this was this picture was taken. That's the only technology which we have. And clinicians, Dr. Stevenson said today that now life is so easy with defibrillators. You just put one in and it's taken care of. Unfortunately, he of course, so he's too enthusiastic about this technology. There are still some issues with that. But nevertheless, this controversy between pharmacological and device approaches to treat cardiac arrhythmias are a good example of this paradigm shift from a molecular approach, from a silver bullet approach, to a more systemic approach. So, like I said, device therapy is not ideal. There are still problems with that, and these problems were recently re-emphasized in a very interesting series of papers, three papers back to back, and then editorial, and then another page in layman terms, published by JAMA in 2006 in April. So what it showed essentially, the great success and also some failures in defibrillation and device therapy. So on the one hand, so this was based on the data available from FDA. So every malfunction in the implantable device in the USA has to be reported to FDA, and there is a full disclosure on this particular case. So what was shown essentially that from 1990 to 2002, there was a nearly tenfold increase in number of implants in the US. And there was also European data and Canadian data, was a big increase. And in pacemakers, there was a threefold increase over the same period of time. I'm not sure, I don't know if Dr. Radek knows why there was such a spike here in 96. It was a really interesting spike. I don't know what it was, but basically a threefold increase is quite impressive. At the same time, what was really disappointing was also increase in the rate of malfunctions. So on the one hand, pacemakers, despite a threefold increase in number of pacemakers implanted, there was a steady decline in malfunctions, and calculated in terms of rate was also a decline. But in ICDs, there was a huge spike increase in malfunctions. Fortunately, after the more recent data after 2002 showed there is a decrease from 2002 to 2004. But again, a trend is clearly visible. It is clearly there.
You have more implantation, you have more malfunction. What's the fraction of malfunction?
Well, basically, if you divide one over another, you still get increase.
You still get
rate is still increased per number of patients. Well, essentially, what I'm trying to say, you're absolutely right. But it, like any technology, it takes time to mature. So, for example, pacemakers, like I showed, they already much more mature technology, polished, and basically, rate of malfunctions is on the decline. What is the difference between pacemaker and defibrillator from double E standpoint? It's really high voltage circuitry primarily. Everything else is probably more or less the same. And sure enough, if you look at the causes of those malfunctions, again disclosed to FDA, you can see that it's primarily battery capacitor, charge circuit, connector header, miscellaneous electrical, and some seal malfunctions. So essentially, majority of those malfunctions are due to high voltage circuitry or high voltage related components, such as connectors, etc. And this again indicates that this technology is still work in progress, and one thing which might help to reduce number of malfunctions is reduction of number of usages of high voltage circuits.
So what's the percent of malfunction?
You can just divide. I mean, this is total hardware malfunctions, and these are essentially.
There are various sources, but just
faster. This is so hardware malfunctions account for 85% of all malfunctions. And for example, battery.
What is the probability of having an ICD malfunctioning?
I think it's. We saw 100,000 ICDs, right. We saw 2,000 failures, so what is that?
A couple percent.
2,000
to 100,000, 2%. Yeah, you see 100,000 a year. Uh-huh. Well, it's somewhat misleading because these are malfunctions for all devices implanted earlier as well. So you have to count for previous ones.
Yes.
So rate, I don't see the numbers. It's probably somewhere in 0.1, 0.2 range from all devices. This was already an explanted one.
Do they get, once you have it, you have it, or do they actually get replaced?
Yeah, actually, Canadian study had several cases when it required replacement, and they even had two deaths due to malfunctions. Yeah. Well, my point is not go into these details. I'm not a clinician. Probably there are people more equipped to answer those questions. My point only was that this technology is still in development, even aside of all physiological mechanisms. Just purely electrical circuitry is not perfect. And now let me just switch to electrophysiological mechanisms. So Vladimir actually gave a very nice overview of one particular theory of defibrillation, but unfortunately, this particular theory is not universally accepted. So there are a number of schools of thought how defibrillation works, and it seems like there are as many theories as researchers in this field, so there's really very little agreement. But historically, there are a number of them. I listed some of them, not all of them, of course. So first theory was introduced by Prevot and Bettelli, who actually invented defibrillation at the very end of 19th century. And it is due to myocardial incapacitation. So in modern terms, we can say that it is due to electroporation, and essentially which makes muscle inexcitable. And as a result, it can also kill ventricular fibrillation. But unfortunately, of course, heart is inexcitable for quite some time after that. So in order to keep the patient alive, you had to do essentially a manual massage of the heart. And this required, of course, open chest procedure. Gurvich introduced stimulatory theory at the end of the 30s. So he essentially introduced what Vladimir was talking about, theoretically, that you can stimulate the whole heart and this would terminate arrhythmia. Steve Dillon, who was the first to apply optical mapping to defibrillation studies, suggested that in addition to stimulation, you can also extend refractoriness of the already refractory tissue. This would also contribute to termination of ventricular fibrillation or tachycardia. Chen and Eidecker formulated the upper limit of vulnerability theory, essentially noticing that there is a probably causal relationship between the fact that there is upper limit of energy which can produce arrhythmia and defibrillation threshold. And finally, Zipes actually was historically earlier than two of these theories, also was talking about critical mass theory of defibrillation. So these are just some of the theories with various degrees of support. But recently, a number of groups contributed to the development of so-called virtual electrode theory, which in fact does not disagree with previous theories. In fact, it kind of unites most of those theories. And historically, virtual electrode concept was first formulated by Cy Furman in 1967. In fact, I didn't know it myself. At some point, I forgot I wrote in some review article about introduction of virtual electrodes by Vixova's group. And Cy Furman wrote to me and said, oh, by the way, I published this paper in 1967 where I introduced this term. It was right there. So indeed, he sent me the copy of this paper. So basically, he tried to explain far-field stimulation, which clearly was beyond space constant from the electrode during chronically implanted pacing. So I have a copy of this paper. Vladimir already talked about activating function as it was introduced by Rattay in 1987, and then classical already Sepulveda's paper from Sepulveda, Roth, and Wixler extended this one-dimensional cable activating function treatment to two-dimensional passive bidomain model. And then finally, I think this is a very interesting paper by Sobi and Leslie Tang. In 1997, they essentially generalized this activating function and produced elegant analytical formulation, which I will show in a couple slides. So essentially, if you write bidomain equations for intracellular and extracellular space, and then you can recalculate introducing transmembrane potential. So if you combine those two equations, so you'll have this term, which essentially is activating function. And in order to understand the physical meaning of this, or biophysical meaning of this term in the equation, so we can essentially assume what happens at rest, quote unquote. So if we assume that membrane is at rest, so then net current is zero, and we can also normalize transmembrane potential to zero, then those two terms can be eliminated. So as a result, this term here essentially shows how quick, what is the rate of change of transmembrane potential in response to external field application. And then if we break apart this term, so we'll get a couple terms here, one of which was essentially Rattay's activating function as it was shown for a single cable. But this is also another term which was not there. And this other term, in fact, accounts for heterogeneities of myocardium itself. So in other words, you might have relatively weak field gradient, yet you can still have a strong activating function if you have very heterogeneous substrate, such as, let's say, fibrosis or infarction scars. Unfortunately, this theory didn't go too far, and I would like to appeal to the theoretical community to actually contribute to further development of this theory, because this is pretty much the last paper of Leslie Tang's group in 1997, which addressed this issue. But this theory, even before it was formulated as generalized activating function theory, contributed to really important example of in the development of cardiac electrophysiology. Namely, this is one of those, unfortunately, rare examples when a phenomenon was predicted purely theoretically, and it took actually quite some time to confirm it experimentally. So Sobi showed that a point injection of current in two-dimensional bidomain shows something like that, and Vladimir already talked about it. Or if you make more sophisticated arrangements for electrodes, bipolar electrodes across the fiber orientation or along the fiber orientation, so you get all these various flowers. And at that time, when originally formulated by Sepulveda, there was no technique to prove it, and only subsequently, nicely, Leslie Tang's group and Wixler's group first formulated for unipolar stimulations, and then we extended it for bipolar stimulations, and using optical mapping, essentially, it was evident that those theoretically predicted patterns are reproduced in actual tissue preparations. And so again, this is just to juxtapose theoretically predicted pattern and experimentally observed distribution of transmembrane potential during current injection. So there's always an area of positive polarization surrounded by areas of negative polarization. So exact anatomical distribution of those areas is driven by activating function, which is a function of both field configuration, essentially electrode arrangements, and muscle configuration. So
in matching experimental and theoretical pattern, I guess one parameter is the difference of anisotropy ratio between 20 and 30.
Right, but this is again for very simple situation when you have uniform, yes.
So how does it come about, and what's the typical value then?
Oh, I don't remember values off the top of my head. I think the intracellular domain has anisotropy ratio of 10.
Yeah.
Extracellular, I believe, about 3.
Yeah. It works at 2.
Yeah, it's in the same, right. Right. So after it was confirmed for point stimulation by several groups, we were interested in looking what happens actually during massive defibrillation shocks. This is paper actually published in 2000 for external field, and we did before that several papers for ICD elite configuration. But in every case, we were able to see that virtual electrodes are created in the area which we can see, which is essentially surface of the preparation. There are large areas of positive polarization, something like that, this response, and large areas of negative polarization, something like that. And Natalia Troyanova constructed a 3D model of the heart in which she reproduce what happens in the tissue depth. As you saw from Vladimir's presentation, it's still a work in progress to prove what exactly is 3D distribution of virtual electrodes in depth of tissue. But regardless of that, what we found was really important extension of previous observations. If one could stimulate whole heart at the same time, this would be wonderful, but unfortunately it's not the case. When you stimulate some part of the heart, some muscle, at the same time you de-excite the other part of the muscle because of negative polarization, negative activating function. And that's really where we believe the problem is. So if you, for example, have some distribution of transmembrane potential post-shock, in which case you have negative and positive polarization, so then positive polarization, if it will be applied during diastolic interval, you excite the muscle, and then there is nothing tricky about it. Vladimir beautifully showed that. If you apply it during refractory period, you extend action potential duration. Dillon showed that in 91. The problem is you at the same time have another area of negative polarization which would de-excite the muscle. And if this de-excitation is strong enough, then you can essentially re-excite the muscle by subsequent wavefront propagation. So in other words, by stimulating myocardium, you can extinguish excitable gaps of arrhythmia, but de-excitation will create new excitable gaps. And that was really what the problem is with monophasic defibrillation. So essentially this is what we formulated as theory of virtual electrode-induced phase singularity, when this de-excited region creates excitable gap and new wavefront may essentially give rise to new re-entry.
When you compare your experiments with Natalia, so I understand from what we saw this morning that the nerve stimulation is continuous by domain. Mm-hmm. So then the Filton equation includes the curvature of the heart and the fibers, which leave some region that don't depolarize. Well, the experiment, right, you see that, you know, high field gradient to depolarize everything. So is it just some kind of qualitative comparison?
No, it's also true in the experiment. So for example, here, so when you have relatively uncurved surfaces, it's also not polarized strong enough. So in this particular case, for example, we have strong positive polarization here, strong negative polarization here, gradient in this area, but gradient below is not as strong. So it's also there are areas which are not as strongly polarized. I probably wouldn't have time, but at the time actually we are looking at the following. So Vladimir already tried to address it experimentally by staining only surface versus depth, and we are actually working on development of forward and inverse problem. So essentially simulating in a bi-domain model first electrophysiological phenomenon and then simulating optical experiment. So and then this would allow us to quantitatively compare, because direct comparison of optical signals to surface activity is completely invalid. So you have to take into account the depth. And I have data, but I'm not sure if I'll have time. So this is basically a very brief introduction, and I don't think so researchers in the defibrillation field will argue that this is essentially what has to be achieved during defibrillation. So shocks must terminate wavefronts that sustain pre-shock VTVF. Then shocks must not induce new wavefronts which may result in VTVF. Then they have to suppress sources of VTVF if such exists, for example, focal sources. And finally, shocks must not suppress post-shock recovery to the normal sinus rhythm. So this is what essentially laundry list what has to be done by the defibrillation shock in order to succeed. Right, so I have biphasic right next. I have a whole section on that, so I'll briefly talk about it. So the entire 20th century, starting from the work of Prevot and Bettelli, who actually did both AC and DC defibrillation, and then initial defibrillation attempts were done by AC defibrillation by Carl Wiggers and Claude Beck, and Paul Zoll also did first transthoracic defibrillation by AC. So he applied 900 volt to the chest of the patient for 7 minutes. So this was how first transthoracic defibrillation was successfully achieved So essentially, up to 90s, when it was really the time of optimizing ICD waveform. So all this work was done on optimizing defibrillation waveform in working in this particular paradigm. Unfortunately, I don't have time to go into too much into details, but just what was really rewarding to us in work on virtual electrode theory was that we had enormous wealth of empirical and clinical evidence that this waveform will be better than that waveform, which was determined in numerous studies. But there was very little explanation why exactly it is so. For example, why biphasic waveform is better than monophasic. So there are theories how it works, but they didn't explain some other aspects of waveform optimization. So virtual electrode theory, as we formulated it, did explain all these differences. For example, we explained the lower and upper limits of vulnerability, basically by creating this strong gradient between positive and negatively polarized areas and launching new waveform. We explained why anodal is better than cathodal shocks when applied and during ICD defibrillation. We explained why biphasic is better than monophasic, and biphasic only of certain configuration. And finally, recently we also explained, which was very old result by Schuder, published in the 60s, why ascending waveforms are better than descending waveforms. And just to very briefly show, so essentially when you apply monophasic shock, you create virtual electrodes and you create new waveform of excitation and reentry, and this is the way you can fail. So as I said already, the Prevot and Betelli were the first to start DC defibrillation. Gurvich reintroduced DC because unfortunately it was forgotten after this work. Nobody tried to do DC defibrillation until, as you can see, 40 years later. And then Gurvich also pioneered biphasic waveform, which was actually already standard in 1970 in defibrillators used in Soviet Union. And in the 90s, biphasic capacitor discharge waveform was already standard in implantable devices. But bottom line is then when you apply monophasic shock, you create virtual electrodes and you fail by launching a new re-entry shown right there. With biphasic shock, you create virtual electrodes to extinguish re-entry, but second phase will extinguish virtual electrodes themselves, preventing new re-entry from reoccurring. So this is basically the explanation. There are a number of waveforms which have been used by various defibrillator companies and various schools of defibrillation. And a lot of work was done, a lot of money was spent optimizing those waveforms. And for example, recently Zoll introduced a waveform in which there is a square pulse instead of a capacitive discharge waveform. A lot of work was done, but essentially the point I'm trying to get to is that it seems that we are already at the really bottom of optimization. We cannot optimize too much more than what we already achieved. So you can get maybe gain of another 15-20%. It's still quite nice, but not more than that. Well, basically, it depends on your point of view. So if you're near the electrode, near anode, it will be what you just said. But if you're near cathode, it will be exactly the opposite. So essentially, one part of the heart will experience negative, but the other will be still positive. So you cannot really avoid that. Quite a few years ago, Schuder published a paper in which he demonstrated that this waveform actually is much more efficient in terminating defibrillation as compared to this waveform. But this waveform essentially is used clinically because of very easy implementation with single capacitor discharge. So circuitry is so simple that it's really hard to beat. So we recently worked on looking at these two waveforms and showed that this waveform is also could be actually more beneficial as compared to the ascending waveform. And we were really pleased to see confirmation of this data in a clinical study by Sharovsky. But again, as I said, difference was 18-20%. So this is as much as you can do with optimizing waveforms. And the problem was that such circuit implementation is a really difficult proposition for implantable devices. Just the size of the circuit and reliability might be a problem. So it's not clear whether Medtronic, which actually did the study, is going to implement it in their device, despite the fact that they can gain some improvement as compared to the competition. Yes?
Duration of the pulses plays a role?
Oh, of course it does play a big role. because essentially time constant of response of membrane depends on so many things, and it's not one time constant. It goes probably from 1 millisecond to 6 or 7 milliseconds. So waveform cannot be shorter maybe than 4 or 5 milliseconds, you know, to be able to depolarize or hyperpolarize most of the muscle. And again, a lot of empirical work was done on that. Still, there are arguments, theoretical arguments, what exactly drives polarization. But it seems that it's already consensus that there is not much more can be done about optimizing waveforms. So, yet, despite all this optimization, despite really high efficacy, one can argue that there are still side effects on the physiological side, even if we ignore circuitry problems such as charging capacitor failure and connector failure. And these are those list of those side effects. So high voltage defibrillation can cause myocardial damage, which could be permanent or transient, myocardial dysfunction, including contractile or electrical dysfunction, and most importantly, pain, which again precludes use of this technology with atrial fibrillation patients. So unlike ventricular arrhythmia patients, which are already unconscious most of the time when they receive therapy and they really don't care about pain much, the atrial fibrillation patients are conscious and they do care about pain. And unfortunately, we are too far away from the pain threshold in order to be able to address this issue with present paradigm of defibrillation. Let me go very quickly. I'll try to convince you that actually electroporation and damage to the muscle is realistic. So measurements of the field during clinically relevant stress showed that endocardium of the heart, even during transthoracic defibrillation, experiences somewhere 30 to 50 volt per centimeter. During ICD defibrillation, it could be even higher near the electrode. So this is an example of an experiment with 50 volt per centimeter external shock, and you can see we used propidium iodide to stain muscle which was affected by electroporation, so you can clearly see that surfaces of endocardial structures are electroporated in quite wide range of tissues. So if you apply much stronger shocks, such as 100 volt per centimeter, and such shock strengths are realistic in the vicinity of ICD lead, so you can see massive electroporation, especially in the areas of blood vessels. So, and this is again far field in our experiment. So the electrodes were at substantial distance from the heart, and the electroporation was pretty widespread. So what are the consequences of electroporation? And they are numerous. First of all, post-shock, there is a diastolic depolarization, which lasts for many seconds, which prevents re-excitation of those cells. And the shock response also is affected because obviously when pores form in the membrane, polarization cannot sustain. So for example, this was the strongest shock which achieved this depolarization, but then this depolarization immediately collapsed because of opening of the pores on the membrane. And this was for hyperpolarizing shocks. Again, there was strong hyperpolarization, but then it was reversed because of opening of the pores in the membrane. Of course, if you have pores in the membrane, then calcium is a problem. So you have entry of calcium in the cell, and this calcium cannot be reuptaken because it's continuous influx of calcium. So these are recordings of intracellular calcium in response to different hyperpolarizing or depolarizing pulses. So in both cases, you can see strong shocks lead to increase of intracellular calcium and all the consequences in mechanics. And Itsuo Kadama, 10 years ago, more than 10 years ago already, also demonstrated that if you take a papillary muscle and you subject it to a high electroporating shock, you might observe this ectopic activity from the papillary muscle. So this was in the range of from 40 to 60 volt per centimeter, which again is consistent with what can be experienced by heart muscle on the endocardium near the ICD lead. So this was done in isolated papillary muscle preparation, and Vladimir did the same experiment in tissue culture preparation, also observed the same. We tried to reproduce it in a whole heart preparation, which we essentially took, as you can see, a rabbit heart. We opened a window over there, and essentially by dissecting part of right ventricle, and we looked at papillary muscle, which was still attached and perfused. And we saw several cases very, very infrequently. I'm repeating this movie over and over again. In reality, it's just one single ectopic beat. We never seen any sustained activity, just single ectopic beat, but it does happen. So I'm not sure if such mechanism actually may result in a sustained arrhythmia, but it does occur. in ventricles. However, more recently just completed a study, so Vadim Fedorov in my lab, so he used electrode which was earlier designed by Vladimir Nikolsky, which allows us to electroporate only a part of the tissue in the field of view while keeping the rest of the tissue normal. So we inject current through a hole in the glass window essentially. And what you can see, so this was normal propagation in the atrium, and after that we applied shock, which electroporated this part of the myocardium, of atrial myocardium. So you can see what happened here. Shock was applied right there, and post-shock you can see there was essentially depolarized tissue. But all other locations, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, as you can see, they sustained arrhythmic events. And I'll show you movies in a subsequent slide. What we essentially observed was at the boundary of this completely depolarized tissue, electroporated tissue, we have ectopic activity which looked like EAD.
Igor, I always thought that the word referred to tiny little holes in the cell membrane,
yes,
not huge holes in the tissue.
Well, of course, this huge hole, not in the tissue, but this whole region was electroporated. Every cell in this whole region had tiny, tiny holes. But this region was quite substantial. I think it was 6 or 7 millimeters in diameter. So you can see that post-shock, there was an ectopic bit right here, which propagated actually in both directions, still didn't induce it right away. Then there was another one, and yet another one, and then after that re-entry was started. So let me show you this in the movie. So this is initiation of re-entry. First beat, then will be second beat, which blocked superiorly and went only inferiorly, and then it started sustained re-entry. And then here it's already given sustained re-entry around electroporated region. However, what was interesting, this electroporation is a transient phenomenon which lasts for seconds or tens of seconds. And upon recovery of this region to normal physiological state, so this re-entry actually unpinned, detached from this obstacle, electroporated obstacle, and self-terminated.
What's the scale of
it? It's probably about a centimeter, maybe a little bit more. So, of course, still a question remained, is there any clinical evidence of post-shock damage or post-shock slowing of the conduction? And we just completed a study looking at ICD patients. So this was randomly selected subsequent patients which received ICD therapy. And we found that from two types of devices, we use Medtronic devices and Guidant devices. Unfortunately, our hospital does not implant St. Jude devices. I don't know why. So in 56 consecutive patients, and the goal is to enroll 200 patients, we found that 87% of defibrillation cases resulted in clear evidence of ventricular slowing of post-shock electrical activity. So first of all, so what we did essentially, we had near field this trace and far field this trace recordings. So we measured width of those QRS complexes. We had a couple of measures. If somebody is interested, I can go through these details. But essentially, those are measures which allow us to estimate conduction time from these recordings. So we found that in this 10 seconds of data, which we have, because devices, unfortunately, do not save more than 10 seconds of data. So we see that in 87% of patients, there is either a failure of recovery whatsoever of any kind of conduction, and it requires then pacing by the device, or first initial several beats have clear evidence of widening of QRS complex or widening of conduction time, which is summarized in this slide. So we have a couple of groups of patients. So in some patients, there was recovery of sinus rhythm post-shock, but in those sinus beats, there was prolongation of conduction time, which slowly recovered with, you can see here, conduction times from 34 to 28 in control milliseconds. And for pacing beats, in those patients which required pacing at any time, so we saw essentially times 136 versus 114 milliseconds. So clearly, defibrillating shocks, ICD shocks, result in slowing of post-shock conduction, which fortunately is transient, but it is there. So now, and also we saw that it is energy dependent. So we had a couple of groups of patients, and it depends on energy. Stronger energy of ICD shock, stronger the slowing of the conduction time. Now we are looking at So we still don't have any evidence, but preliminary data indicates, suggests that, that essentially those patients which have stronger slowing of post-shock propagation, they also have higher rates of reoccurrence of ventricular fibrillation and also higher rates of failure of defibrillation. This one?
Yeah.
Basically, these are number of beats, bit number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, so 10 beats post-shock. Yeah, so let's say take this record. There are number of beats here shown after shock. This is shock application. What we did, we measured essentially conduction time assessed by these two electrograms in two groups of patients. In one group... No, this is not atrial. This is near field and far field. These are all ventricular electrograms. So near field is recording electrical activity from the apex of right ventricle, and the other pole is just above it. So I don't know, is it about half an inch or something like that? An inch?
Centimeter or two.
Right. And the other one, this one, is recording from the same pole in the RV apex endocardial and the CAN, the device itself, so the far field. So we have those two recordings, and based on those two recordings, we estimated conduction time.
So, you say it's due to damage because after the rapid stimulation due to the ventricular tachycardia, that could potentially, or the fibrillation, that could just lead to a slowing of conduction and a depression of excitability, which will recover over time.
Yes, it's true, but we also compare it to those shocks which were used to induce ventricular fibrillation after normal rate, and we saw the same effect. Both. So these are intrinsically and these are paced. So these two panels, A and B. So my point essentially is that although ICD therapy works very well and highly efficient, but clearly there are still issues which can be addressed by significant reduction in energy of defibrillation. And in particular, what would be very important if we can achieve this kind of reduction for atrial fibrillation patients. So this is what we've been working in collaboration with Dr. Krinsky for already several years. And we use several models. So one of the models is this chronic infarct in the rabbit heart. And essentially, this model, of course, is somewhat simpler than the human model, which was described today in the beautiful lecture in the morning. But it, I think, it recapitulates very interesting features of human ventricular tachycardia. So when you ligate a branch of left coronary artery in the rabbit heart, so you get this very large scar, but endocardium will always survive, and you have very, very fine layer of endocardial border zone. So shown here on the inset using immunohistochemistry, so there's disruption of connexin, so you can see very few connexin plaques at the junctions between cells, which essentially supports very, very slow and safe conduction, and number of groups showed in dog model and other infarction models how this can translate into ventricular tachycardia. So we've mapped those hearts from rabbits, and essentially we confirmed what was found earlier in dogs. That area around, in this case, near the scar, above the scar, as you can see, scar area is right here. There is slow conduction over the scar, and then continuation will be on next. So you can see rotation right here, which corresponds to this area. So essentially, consistently, dog model, we found that scar tissue really attracts ventricular tachycardia reentrant circuit. Currently, it's a work in progress, but I just like to want to share it because same questions were in human studies. What kind of imaging modalities one can use to more quantitatively address reentrant pathways? So in collaboration with Sam Wickline from Washington University, so we actually, after we map this heart optically, we can put it in a diffusion tensor MRI and quantify fiber disarray in this region. So this is, for example, one of the sections. And you can see that septum and RV are well arranged. This is one part of the free wall of left ventricle. But this region of the scar is completely disrupted. and it's shown here on the inset. So again, you can see here very nicely arranged fibers which rotate from epi to endocardium, but in this region of the scar, it's completely disrupted. And at the present time, we're working in collaboration with Natalia Troyanova, who is building a 3D bi-domain model, which will be essentially built for every heart which we study with these technologies. Another model we are looking at is this model, which is a beta myosin heavy chain mutation, which results in, as you can see, in tremendous hypertrophy, and it's extremely arrhythmogenic. So we found in this model that upper limit of vulnerability and defibrillation threshold are threefold as compared to normal control rabbits, which are age matched. And what is interesting also in this model, there is some moderate degree of fibrosis, but also you can see some areas of disrupted fibers as well, in addition to just pure anatomical thickening of the wall. Also, I'd like to share a couple data slides done with Natalia Troyanova. And this was a micro-MRI done at Oxford University. So essentially, this group achieved 25 micron resolution, and it allows to take to reconstruct 3D structure of a given heart rather than average picture of many, many hearts as it was done by Andrew McCulloch's group, by tedious work of postdoc shaving his heart for 4 or 5 years and then measuring million nodes under microscope. So this particular single heart was imaged and reconstructed to a bi-domain model. So Natalia was able to reproduce conduction in his heart. Another technology which we did in our lab is optical coherence tomography. So this is endocardium of a particular preparation which we studied, and I'll show you in subsequent slides. And then Natalia took this 3D data set from OCT, optical coherence tomography, and reconstructed a bi-domain model from this particular.
The previous slide, I'm still thinking about it, yes. You see that's three times larger, the energy to defibrillate the thicker muscle.
Well, I think it's not only about thickness, it's also about really disrupted structure.
Right, so that's interesting because you know what it is more the disruptiveness of the tissue or the...
No, at this point we don't know. I mean, actually we are working, so these were 3-year-old rabbits with already advanced some degree of fibrosis. Now we're looking at 1.5-year-old rabbits which have no evidence of fibrosis, but substantial thickening of the wall. So this is essentially what we are trying to address. But we don't have any data yet.
Just remember when I was thinking about your initial November for that, the sawtooth, the size would not depend.
Right.
While the bi-domain fiber curvature is scaled with the... Yeah, so people look systematically at different sizes of parts and the relationship.
Well, that's what Flavio wants to do, right? Different sizes. It's a very expensive proposal. I don't know if you can convince study section to do that, just looking at the size.
Yeah, I understand. That's a different story.
Yeah. No, we don't have data about that.
The hypertrophy is data, but then you have two things changing, the thickness and the...
Right.
I didn't get this reconstruction thing. So if you reconstruct one given... But okay, you have
much more,
but you have no heart.
Well, of course, we're doing it the other way around. So first we take the heart, we do electrophysiology experiment. We fully characterize the heart. So I showed you this 3D movie, so it was done first. So after that, we take this heart, send it to Sam Wickline across the campus to do diffusion and tensor MRI, so he would reconstruct for us the fibers. And then we take it back and then we conduct actually histology and immunohistochemistry, because we, in addition to that, we also want to characterize connexin distribution and distribution of myocytes and fibroblasts. So, and in some cases, we add some other proteins as well, so it depends on the protocol. And then also some hearts probably will be sent to Oxford University to do a micro-MRI, which I haven't heard about better resolution than Oxford group has at the present time. So now essentially we are arriving at the low voltage defibrillation part of the project. So what I hope I convinced you is that there are plenty of scarce and resistive heterogeneities in various models of arrhythmias, and clearly it is a problem in humans. According to clinical statistics, I believe it's about 80% of the patients with ventricular tachycardia or recipients of ICDs have coronary, a history of coronary artery disease. And there is plenty of biophysical evidence, both from simulations and experimental studies, that re-entry can be stabilized or pinned to the scar or any other resistive heterogeneity. This is on the one hand. On the other hand, if you look back to the activating function equation, any kind of resistive heterogeneity plugs in the second part of the activating function, and it will provide this virtual electrode or secondary source, or whatever you want to call it. Vladimir is right, there is still no agreement what terminology to use, but essentially it will produce anatomical substrate for creating depolarization or hyperpolarization. So then the question arises, can we take advantage of those two phenomena, because biophysically they are essentially identical, that if we target very little energy, but we target only in the core of reentry, we might be able to get away with significant reduction in defibrillation energy. So Dr. Krinsky already showed you this data last week. Just to restate it, so if you have reentry rotating around very simplified scar, and if you apply a very small pulse which will hyperpolarize here, depolarize here, you can unpin or destabilize this reentry. And then if you have a square heart which fits on the screen, then it will terminate. But in real heart, of course, it's a little bit more complicated, and yet I'll show you evidence that it actually works too.
Even terminate cables went from anatomy called.
Right, but then it essentially left, left the building, and that is how it was terminated. Also, Dr. Krinsky spent quite some time talking about phase dependence. So if you apply it during this phase of re-entry by hyperpolarizing here and depolarizing here, you will unpin and terminate, but if you apply pulse, same pulse in counter phase, you will not do much. So essentially there will be no damage to the muscle or to the re-entry circuit. Which is good and bad. So bad because how do we know what is the phase of particular reentry circuit when we don't even know where the source of the circuit is? On the other hand, it's good because if we apply pulse in inappropriate phase, we don't do anything. So first series of experiments was done by Crystal Riplinger, a graduate student in my lab, and Vladimir Nikolsky, who just left to work for Medtronic. And what it was essentially, it was a superfused right ventricular preparation. And in this preparation, we tried to recapitulate a situation with infarction, acute infarction, and when only superfused endocardial layer will be alive. And then we used essentially two plate electrodes. We applied pulses during various phases of reentry. What was nice about this preparation, which was confirmed by immunohistochemistry, we used two antibodies, phospho-specific and unphospho-specific connexin 43 for a serine 368 residue. And this particular residue, phosphorylation of this particular residue, was shown to be associated with uncoupling between two cells. Unfortunately, it was shown to be associated with uncoupling, but which way? It depends which paper you read. So if you read paper of Jeff Saffitz, so he said that essentially phosphorylation is required for coupling between cells. But recently a couple papers appeared in Circulation which state exactly the opposite. What we found with these antibodies that surface of the preparation, which was superfused of 0.38 millimeter, remained coupled, and the mid-myocardium was entirely uncoupled. And it's shown yet another preparation. Here, as you can see, only superficial layers were coupled here. This particular preparation was actually superfused both on this side and on that side, but most of the time we kept it pinned very tightly, so having only superficial layer attached. So we tried to essentially reach two goals. First of all, we wanted to make sure that we know exactly what happens with electrical activity in the entire preparation. We don't want to miss anything, because then there will be questions about three-dimensionality and the other side of the preparation. So this is one side of the story, so essentially two-dimensionality. And second, we wanted to essentially reproduce situation with acute myocardial infarction, and most of the mid-myocardium is dead, uncoupled, and you have only this layer of endocardial border zone. And we were lucky enough that in this preparation, re-entry was very easily inducible. So crystal could induce and reinduce in the same preparation many times. And of course, it would pin somewhere and it will be very stable, but pinning was achieved in various places. In some preparations, we only had 2-3 places to which it could pin. In some preparations, it could be 7, 8, or 9 different sites of pinning. So what are the anatomical substrates for pinning? Like in previous case, let me go back for a second. This particular preparation, this pinning site, was due to the fact that uncoupling or dephosphorylation of connexin 43 penetrated all the way to the surface. So essentially, this muscle was not excitable very well. So as a result, it could easily pin to this inexcitable region. In this preparation, as you can see, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 different sites. And in some cases, you have just very gross trabeculae on the endocardium. In some cases, as I show you on subsequent slide, it was more minute differences in fiber orientation. But without exceptions, we saw that those areas which were areas of pinning also were areas of oppositely charged virtual electrodes or secondary sources. Here and here. Of course, also we saw areas which did not work as pinning sites, yet there were still those secondary sources present. Structural characteristics of myocardium, which served as pinning sites, were of different kind. So this is one of the preparations in which we observed only 2 sites for pinning. So this one was very, very reproducible. I believe we had about 90% of reentries pinning to that particular site. And this was less reproducible, about 10% of the sites. So after experiment was done, we conducted optical coherence tomography imaging. So this particular site here, shown right here, and you can see it's strongly trabeculated. So all this trabeculae probably were responsible for pinning. But this particular site, when we looked first on our 3D data set, there was nothing remarkable about it. So it was really nice and smooth, and fibers were oriented perfectly. But then we sectioned it in a vertical direction, and the optical coherence tomography data set gives us this opportunity. We found that, so there was slight rotation of fibers overall, but for example, in this corner, so this red dot represents this particular section, and this represents a somewhat deeper section, about 50 micron deeper. So you can see that in this corner, fiber orientation was consistent, but in this corner, fiber rotated nearly 60 degrees over a very short distance of 50 microns. So this sharp rotation of fibers probably was responsible for pinning of reentry. And I am curious if somebody can run a simulation to actually study that, how abrupt shift in fiber orientation can be responsible for pinning the reentry. Each dot here represents an instantaneous location of phase singularity during one. So, and they consider a family of dots taken during several cycles of reentry.
What's the whole? Sorry, I don't get the geometry of the rapid. Is the rapid change in the same plane or?
No. It's about 50 micron difference in depth. So you go deeper, 50 micron, and you get 60 degrees rotation.
60 degree, and then the reentry is in which.
We don't know that. I mean, we don't have that kind of resolution. We only know that if you average together, that's where it's sitting in this region.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wish we have a resolution like that, but we don't.
But doesn't that occur, like, over the whole circuit? Like, if you go anywhere, mm-hmm. Would you have that sharp transition if you go down?
Could be, but again, this is just a hypothesis. I'm not saying it's a proven fact. Probably there are some other areas as well. Dr. Pertsov, I believe, showed that in peak heart, you have that everywhere.
Miguel Rabanas been doing experiments looking at an isotropy, and then one half of the monolayer goes this way and the other half goes this way. And it's amazing. I mean, in those monolayers, you see spiral waves that will go on for a half hour pinned.
On that border?
Yeah. Right along the border. Mm-hmm. They stick in one spot in that border.
Yep.
And if you have uniform anisotropy, they will just meander off the tissue and self-terminate.
Yeah, and your story with papillary muscle insertion is essentially the same.
Simulations like right. That, it also the papillary works. Where mm-hmm. It does.
Right.
We don't understand the mechanism. We haven't been able to model.
This area also seems to be the same. You see, you have predominant orientation here and then 90 degrees
right.
Twist.
What does the model do? Yeah.
That's something different.
Yeah.
We have seen a number of simulations where it does kind of tend to spend a lot more time in that region and sort of quasi-weak to that boundary.
Well, the good news is that we are accumulating this data, and we have optical coherence tomography data now from every pinning site. So as soon as we start making some sense out of it, and Natalia will help us to build a 3D model.
What's the hole in panel E?
Hole? Which hole?
Panel E.
Which? E? Oh, this one. It's a slight invagination of tissue right here. You see? Well, there are many like that all over the tissue, so it doesn't seem to be. I mean, if you go everywhere, these slight invaginations are everywhere.
So, how did you do with roots, and was it always going around in the same direction?
Induction was done just by burst pacing. Burst pacing.
From where?
For example, from here or from here. She would usually drag electrode in different locations.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but essentially it will pin steel regardless where the electrode.
And does it always go in the same orientation?
Not necessarily, but it would pin to those several predominant spots. It could go either way. So in this particular preparation, Crystal conducted, I believe, 20 plus experiments by now, and essentially she was able to reproduce almost entirely what was done in the model. So this is an example. In this particular field of view, preparation actually extends beyond this field of view, what we have, line of block and re-entry rotating around this line of block. I'll show a movie in the next slide. And then when wavefront was located right here, she applied very pulse with very small intensity, I forgot whatever it was, below 1 volt per centimeter. And the secondary source was produced right here, then the secondary source, and then another one here. They merged with the wavefront, and then this unified wavefront went to the left and essentially collided with the boundary of the preparation and terminated, while the other wavefront went around line of block. It was essentially reset re-entry and didn't have enough time for recovery. It also self-terminated. So this is fully consistent with what was done with the bi-domain model. When the same was repeated, let me first show the movie. So again, this is first rotation, second rotation, now it will be pulse, secondary source, and then termination. So these panels show fluorescence map, so essentially raw data as it comes out of photodiode array, phase map, done by, I believe it was Hilbert transform, and then a trajectory of phase singularities. Let me show you again. So again, you see this phase singularity here. Now pulse and termination. So when she moved phase by pi, by 180 degrees, so now wavefront is right here. Essentially, re-entry was, of course, reinduced, again pinned to the same location. So and wavefront was right here, and then she applied pulse. So the secondary source was produced here, and they merged, and essentially nothing really. I'm sorry, the secondary source was produced here, where it's refractory, and nothing happened, and wavefront continued the same uninterrupted pathway. So there was no even shift of phase in this re-entry. And you can see it right here.
Was detection of the waveform during the experiment in terms of timing the pulse done from the optical signal, or did you have
from electrogram? Yeah, we had a real-time circuit which sensed electrogram, and it was analog circuit, so threshold detector essentially. And you can in lab you type in whatever phase you want, and it's real-time, so it was very quick. Response time was something like 100 microseconds, I believe. So it was within our resolution. So overall, what Crystal did after analyzing all these experiments, essentially, first of all, we did reproduce phase dependence. So those red crosses show when it was unpinned, and distance from the center indicates what energy with which it was achieved. So you can see half a volt, 0.7, and 1 volt per centimeter. And this is statistics with the E70. E80 at 1.2 volt per centimeter, or if Dr. Klinsky wanted to calculate in terms of energy, it gives you about 20-fold reduction in defibrillation energy.
As against what?
Against a normal 5.4 volt per centimeter, which is
that thin tissue.
for any tissue which is considered as a defibrillation gold standard. Oh, size differed. It depends on what anatomical structure. It could be as large as probably 7 millimeters and as small as 3 millimeters.
So 3 millimeters is the bulk.
Mm-hmm. But not more than 1 centimeter.
Your space constant is half a millimeter?
I don't know how to measure space constant, frankly. Probably.
So that would mean that half a volt per centimeter, you're probably reaching the excitation threshold. Mm-hmm. Or that 3 millimeter obstacle.
Yeah. I showed earlier virtual electrodes, we reach about 10 millivolt amplitude for depolarization, which would be probably sufficient, right? Near the heterogeneity.
So 10 millivolts
is on the water. Yes, but it is... No, it was 10 and was sufficient.
Did you try to measure the defibrillation threshold, not as a gold standard, but in your preparation?
In this particular next study, I'll show you. Basically, we had a lot of questions about this preparation because of size, because of scale, etc., etc. Although, I don't know how many of you saw, Panfilov just published a point of view article in Heart Rhythm, where he claims that rabbit is a better model than dog for human studies. So it's clearly controversial, there will be a lot of discussion about it, but basically he argues that in addition to just pure anatomical scale of the organ, we have to also pay attention to biophysical properties and wavelength in particular. And he argues that rabbit heart is a better model. And in fact, recently a group from England presented a couple of posters, I haven't seen papers yet, Dr. Taggart and Martin Nash, showing mapping of ventricular fibrillation in humans. And it seems that it's pretty simple as compared to dogs. So it has really very few phase singularities, a very few circuits. But again, it's whatever it is, we did dogs too. And I was fortunate that we have next door from us Dr. Rick Schussler, who has very nice tools for study of this particular model. I believe Dr. Boyden presented it last week, which is the same model as was used in Colombia. Essentially, you produce, insert a balloon in the left coronary artery branch, inflate it for 2 hours, producing infarction. Then you deflate it and remove it, and 4 days later, close the chest of the dog. And 4 days later, you get infarct in this dog, but epicardial region is epicardial border zone. And in this zone, you can induce sustained ventricular tachycardia. And then you use mapping system to map this tachycardia very nicely. And so this is an example. So how it looks like, so it's a stereo view of this projection of the heart. If you place it at the apex, you have slowing of the conduction over this epicardial border zone, which is consistent with previous studies. And in this model, we had some trouble in the beginning how to reproduce stable ventricular tachycardia. I called Dr. Witt, and he was generous to share with me that essentially flecainide would help. So in this model, we used flecainide to sustain ventricular tachycardia. So otherwise, our data was consistent with his data in terms of longevity of ventricular tachycardia circuit. So essentially, in 1/3 of the dogs without flecainide, you can only induce very brief runs of tachycardia, about 10 or so rotations. In 1/3, you cannot even induce, and in 1/3, you can induce more sustained. But with flecainide, it was actually sustained with nice morphology. So in this model, we essentially applied the same paradigm. So we have ventricular tachycardia, it was sustained in nearly all cases without exceptions by a figure of eight reentry. In one case, we saw actually nice spiral wave. Not figure of eight reentry, but a single spiral wave over this region, but it was only one case like that. And then we scanned a cycle of ventricular tachycardia with one single pulse. We had we divided it by 20, 40, 60, and 80% of the cycle, and we applied pulses of various energy. And so in this case, for example, I'm showing an example when in dog number two, we had termination with 0.4 joules of energy. So invariably, after successful termination, we had several rotations of ventricular reentrant circuit, and then it would self-terminate. So I'll show the same data as a movie. So this is sustained ventricular tachycardia. So raw data, you can see how it, this is isthmus of reentry going in both directions. And the next is termination. So in this particular case, it terminated actually right in the isthmus. And the next will be, beat will be already sinus rhythm.
Where are the electrodes placed?
It was an ICD configuration. Let me show you previous picture here. So essentially, we didn't use transvenous approach. There was just a small hole made in the RV, and electrode was placed all the way in the apex. So it's a one single ICD lead in the apex of the right ventricle. Same configuration which is used clinically.
Far from the core,
right? Yeah, I would say it's at a distance, right? Another example, in this case we had quite a few rotations, so we destabilized re-entry, and it's also self-terminated after 12 rotations. So what was interesting in this model, when re-entry was pinned to this car, anti-tachycardia pacing, it was not completely inefficient, so we were unable to terminate unless we put electrode right on the isthmus. But from the ICD lead location, we were unable to terminate this re-entry. I was wondering, what is the clinical experience in patients with this classical isthmus type ventricular tachycardia?
Well, usually the defibrillator is programmed to give a burst of pacing, and if it doesn't work, to then follow it with a shock. And the impression is that if the VT is monomorphic and slow, the shocks are very, very effective, but they're always, well, they always have to be programmed above the pain threshold.
Right. But anti-tachycardia pacing
is effective fairly frequently for slow VTs. And there is some data, I don't know if Ray knows, it's probably like 60 or 70% of the time a monomorphic VT can be terminated with the pacing, maybe a little more than that even. Mm-hmm.
So this is an example of this particular, it's post-pulse already activity. You can see that post-pulse re-entry circuit clearly shifted from this isthmus location where it was residing before application of pulse. And it lasted for 12 beats and then self-terminated. So in this study, we did not attempt to apply anti-tachycardia pacing after the pulse. It is our next step of the project.
Mm-hmm. You missed something. I thought the theory was that the low energy shock was supposed to happen right near the core.
Well, this would have been wonderful, but we don't know where the core is.
Yeah, I know, but I thought wasn't that the theory, the modeling?
No. Your shock could be applied by far-field electrodes. But even in this case, still, virtual electrodes will be created, induced mostly at heterogeneities, which happen also to be points of attraction for re-entry circuit. But placement of electrode can be far, far away. So this is an example of one of those experiments. Again, as you can see, this was ECG. We have five different phases during which we applied pulses. And also these are energies which we applied. So what was interesting, so first of all, when we thought about this idea of low energy pulses, number of clinicians told me that, oh yeah, I tried it like in 1980. And then in many cases, I converted this relatively mild, slow ventricular tachycardia into ventricular fibrillation. And why would I do such a thing to a patient? So basically, we were completely aware of that. And this is an example of that, which was actually reproducible. So when you apply a 50-volt pulse, you can see that in this phase, at 80%, we were able to reproducibly defibrillate, to terminate reentry. At any other phase, nothing happened. If we increase it to 100 volt, look what happens. So in these two phases, so here blue dots correspond to nothing, no effect, but blue dots, you can see that we converted VT to another VT. If we go a little bit up, those yellow dots are even worse. So you can see we converted VT to VF. And that's what we really want to avoid. And a completely out of phase estimate was we needed about 350 volt. So what was really reassuring, that there is a window of opportunity below this particular area of reinduction of arrhythmia, which we can take advantage of. And interestingly, There is a nice saying in Russian that every new idea is a well old ones. And this is one paper I did, one of the first papers I did as a postdoc in Dr. Salama's lab, when we applied a sub-threshold high-frequency stimulation. And I remember one of the reviewers asked us, what exactly, why do you need such low energy, why don't you increase energy, and why increased energy is even worse than smaller energies. And we come up with a response that perhaps there is indeed a slow limit of vulnerability in a sense, but for burst pacing. So essentially, when you exceed a certain threshold, you may terminate ongoing arrhythmia, but you will reinduce it right away. But with lower energy, you essentially terminate and not reinduce, and this is why it was called sub-threshold stimulation. At that time, we used it was, I believe, 50 hertz pacing, not related in any way to cycle length of arrhythmia ongoing in this model. This was a guinea pig heart. But it was, interestingly, was effective in guinea pig heart. So essentially, our next step, which is work in progress, we are designing a protocol, and already have preliminary data, which supports that if you apply a number of pulses, so far we found that five to four pulses is the probably most appropriate. You put it only those number of pulses of very low energy into the cycle length of ventricular tachycardia, so you can reliably terminate it. So far, we've done it only in the rabbit heart, and it is quite efficient. So, and then in the larger heart, in the dog heart, we are thinking about extending also this therapy by applying standard anti-tachycardia pacing protocol, following those multiple pulses. It's another issue. So far, it's because it's just the beginning of the work, we only used monophasic pulses. But we think that you're absolutely right, so that this could be clearly improved even further by applying not only biphasic, but we're actually thinking about rotating the field for some like subcutaneous defibrillator. You can have more flexibility with arranging the waveform. Another interesting point is, which is kind of embarrassing to admit, but a defibrillator which we have also has its own low limit. We cannot go below 50 volt. Unfortunately. So essentially, data which I show is somewhat an overestimate. So we don't know what will happen if we apply below 50 volt. So we're now working on designing a better circuit for that.
What's the advantage of this for termination of VT over anti-tachycardia pacing?
Well, in those cases when anti-tachycardia pacing doesn't work, that's essentially what we're trying to say, is that this protocol will precondition re-entry circuit by destabilizing it before application of anti-tachycardia pacing. So those cases which are resistant to anti-tachycardia pacing can be essentially improved by application of that particular approach.
So, I mean, in the theory that tunnel can prevention, the idea is that, so what, like the opposite group. So at low shock, so at small energy, you get the visual electrode from the big obstacle, right? And as you increase the field strength, you start to recruit smaller obstacles. But it seems like from the talk this morning that the more common isthmus or whatever or narrow pathways actually is really damaged tissue, it is very complicated conduction.
But they attach to very large obstacles. So essentially they are very easily polarizable.
Yeah, but what happens when I apply the field in such a geometry? I should be thinking about the size of the big obstacle.
Yeah. In rabbit preparation, we had several cases when we had isthmus type reentry, clearly isthmus, so we had essentially, let's say, a bundle attached only in two points to the rest of the myocardium. So in those cases, we found actually it's even easier to apply pulse because you essentially depolarize this isthmus very easily, and then VT will terminate right away. It's not even unpinning, it's just terminated at the isthmus.
Why would people try that? It seems that like a nice idea that you would just have for people have these kind of VTs with fairly large pathways or well-defined pathways, you could just give a small shock.
Well, when small shocks are given with defibrillators, it's always been traditionally synchronized to the QRS. And there's not a mechanism for synchronizing it
different phase.
Some other way. With present defibrillators are all just programmed to give it synchronous to the QRS. You can give a low voltage shock, and it's not done that commonly because there's a higher incidence of inducing internal ventricular fibrillation.
Right. And another issue is that you cannot apply, let's say, 5 pulses during a short period of time. Hardware does not permit to do that.
Not too high rates to induce.
Well, as I said, we see in the window of opportunity. Of course, it's still hypothetical. We have to prove that. But it seems that there is a narrow window below this threshold of inducing VEF or converting VT to VEF, from which we can take advantage. But clearly, one single pulse is not going to work. So it has to be train of pulses because we are unable to really detect this phase of unpinning without knowing where the core is.
But then why does the low energy reinduce VT of VF? Because in principle, you should only be producing virtual electrodes from large obstacles, not from small. So what is the mechanism for reinducing?
That I don't know.
Well, again, it's a matter of scale. What exactly is low, what exactly is high?
Yeah.
So as we showed both with burst pace in Lingis Alama's lab and with these protocols, you can get to sub-threshold values when you don't induce reentrant arrhythmia.
So by sub-threshold, you mean something that is not going to induce an action potential?
Yeah, when we did this particular paper with Guy in 94, so by sub-threshold, we meant literally that this energy during diastolic interval did not produce any excitation. So it was essentially we measured excitation threshold and then cut it in half. This is how we determined this energy. So, well, let me now summarize. So in this dog study, we found that we could reduce energy from 6.1 when shock is applied in least favorable phase of ventricular tachycardia to 0.3 joule when it is applied in most favorable phase of tachycardia. So, and we believe that this is a good number because various studies show that pain threshold, for example, is somewhere between 0.01 to 0.1 joule. If it's any closer to 0.1, we are very, very close. And I already said that this data is not optimized in many ways. So we don't have biphasic waveform yet in this study. We used monophasic. We don't have, unfortunately, ability to go below 50 volt in this defibrillator, which also will cut down on this. And we are very hopeful. So we also think that this particular energy definitely will not induce myocardial dysfunction and also hopefully will eliminate pain. Along with all those advantages, we also hope that for atria, this energy can be cut down even more because of size of the atria. Clearly, defibrillation threshold for atria is lower than ventricular defibrillation threshold. So if we can get below, let's say, 0.01 joule for atrial defibrillators, then we can treat to develop painless defibrillation.
Have you tested it yet in the presence of multiple wavelets or anything? Because that's what it needs
In this model, we did not see multiple wavelets so far. So it's really, we're only talking about ventricular tachycardia at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically my question was the same. Mm-hmm. So in full-fledged fibrillation, not that much evidence for pinning. So
right. We don't know about full-fledged fibrillation and we don't speculate that it will work. Again, it depends. We don't know what fibrillation is, if it's a mother rotor or not. Right. Let me just acknowledge. So Dr. Schussler was really generous to participate in the project and provided his beautiful lab for mapping and for surgeries. So Crystal did the rabbit project, and Vadim did the dog project with Dr. Schussler. And all these other guys already moved. So this guy is at St. Jude now. Vladimir is Medtronic. Alex also at Medtronic. And Joanna is at Cleveland Clinic, and Lee is Dr. Heidegger's lab right now. So, and of course, NIST group made a major contribution in the development of these protocols. So, thank you. So, we can go to have cheese and wine.
Oh, there's cheese and wine. Well, I asked my question during the I guess it will, I was wondering if there'd be a way of combining MRI, imaging of infarct, sort of know how to gauge those energies based on some size, energy, for virtual electrode relationship, but maybe it's not in the real process.
Well, I don't know. One issue was raised by several people here in this room and earlier, obviously, that if you would know where the circuit is, and you can put the electrode closer to it, so you might get away with a much smaller energy. So maybe in those cases, when you do have some clear evidence of scar, and maybe that's the region where most arrhythmias would take place. If such a site is fairly accessible for implantation, then maybe you will really reduce defibrillation energy even without this unpinning protocol. So in this respect, Harvard does these studies, WashU does it, probably everybody does those studies to trying to apply MRI imaging modality and other imaging modalities to pinpoint scar regions. But we are not very flexible in where you can stick your electrode.
Igor, as I thought about it more, I realized I didn't understand your answer about when you said that the sort of the series of these low voltage pulses sort of set the sort of precondition for the anti-tachycardia pacing. Could you elaborate on that?
So our theory is as follows. If you have well stabilized reentry circuit pinned attached to nice scar, so and your excitable gap is too narrow, then anti-tachycardia pacing is not efficient. When it is efficient, then there is nothing to do, it's already taken care of. But in those cases, when it's well stabilized, it's not efficient. So essentially, anti-tachycardia pacing induced wavefront cannot penetrate to the core of reentry. It dies before getting there. But if you destabilize it, making it functional reentry circuit, then you can really get there. So this is essentially the theory which remains to be proven.
I thought that the anti-tachycardia pacing worked best in the presence of stabilized.
For slow VTs, yes. If if you have very wide excitable gap, then it should work very well. Yeah. I don't know if I understand it correctly.
And it actually works for some faster VTs,
right,
too, more often than it's been appreciated. There's a tendency now to program devices so they automatically give it one or two tries, even in the fast VT zone, and then follow it with a shock, because it does seem to work more often than in life.
There was a trial, right? There was a paper.
Yeah, several. But also there was analysis published as a follow-up by Vinod Sharma from Medtronic, who basically participated in this trial, and he looked at capture by anti-tachycardia pacing. So he tried to determine which pulse actually terminated, when it's successful or not successful. And you can see that capture happens. Sometimes there is no capture at all when it fails. So it doesn't penetrate really in this excitable gap.
Could you just tell us what the algorithm is for anti-tachycardia pacing that's most commonly used now, or that you would use for programming?
Well, there are a whole bunch of different ones that are possible, but what ends up happening is everybody just takes the simplest thing, which is simply a burst of pacing, usually a fixed cycle length.
Eight pulses. Eight pulses at 88% of the cycle length.
Eight pulses at 88%.
That's very common. And then if you do two or three, maybe it will decrement each cycle length. Yeah.
Eight. Yeah.
Cases where you converted VT to VF, was that because the circuit,
yeah, we looked at those cases. There are a couple complications with that. First of all, you probably noticed that in those maps we have a gray area, so which basically corresponds to our inability to see any signals. Still, with this pulse, there is a dead. You see, for example, this is time during shock application in here. So we sometimes don't see this particular moment, how exactly it's induced. And another issue is this mapping system, unfortunately, only has this particular aspect of the heart, anterior essentially and lateral view, but we don't see the other side. And now Rick Schuster has beautiful 3D plunge needles. You know, they did a lot of studies even in humans back in the 80s. So they still have those electrodes sitting on the shelf. So we will be doing this. So this is actually very interesting indeed, why exactly we induce. But it does seem that we essentially induce several secondary sources in different sites, and some of them can essentially be essentially wave shock on T mechanism. So you produce secondary source on T wave of ongoing wave front or wave tail, and you create essentially figure of eight reentry.
Yeah.
1 inch. 1 inch.
Yeah. Thank you.